Yes, welcome to the Library Colloquia series. Tonight, there's going to be a couple things. We're going to show a video, Dying to be Heard, and then we have a couple speakers. Our first speaker is Gary Morgan, has been director of the Michigan State University Museum since 2009. He has a background in the sciences with a PhD in zoology from Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. He worked as a National Parks and Wildlife Manager and Wilderness Conservation Officer, and he was director of the Western Australian Museum. And then our other speaker is Pamela Rasmussen, and she's assistant curator of the MSU Museum, and she's also assistant professor in the zoology department. Her research focuses on conservation, biodiversity, and vocalization of birds, particularly South Asian birds. And she recently completed a revised edition of her book, Birds of South Asia, The Ripley Guide. I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Susan Kendall, and I'm biology librarian here at the MSU Libraries. So now I'll turn it over to Gary's going to say something.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and thanks for joining us this evening. 50 years ago, a very significant book was published. It was the book Silent Spring, written by Rachel Carson. And it was significant because, in a very meaningful way, it changed entirely the way we the generic, looked at our environment and our relationship to it. We're going to start tonight with a documentary that was made here at MSU by the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. It was made back in 2007. And it's a 28-minute documentary, and it deals with one part of the Silent Spring story. Silent Spring story, of course, is a book that includes many, many, probably hundreds of different case studies about the impacts of pesticides on the environment. But one of the most famous of those case studies happened right here. And it was studied by faculty and students right here on campus. And that is the story that Dying to be Heard actually explores. The documentary was based, or it was at least informed by an article by the then director of the Knight Center, Jim Detchen. He wrote a piece called Breaking the Silence. And the documentary itself was produced and written by Lou Doria. It was made by MSU students, and it's a very high-quality piece. I think it's a very strong piece and has shown extensively on public television, both in Michigan and further afield, and still gets aired from time to time. So I'm sure it will, in fact, be seen again into the future. And if you want to Google it, you'll find some video clips at least, which are online now. The DVD is also available through the Knight Center. So if any of you are interested in getting your own copy, then it will be very easily done. Now, I don't mean to say too much before the show. I think the documentary really speaks very well for itself. But once it's played, what we'll do is discuss a little about the story. I've got a PowerPoint which sets that story into the bigger Silent Spring picture. And my colleague, Pam Rasmussen, who, unlike myself, is a well-trained and very well-known ornithologist, we'll be able to expand substantially on some of the stories that relate to pesticides and birds. So I think on that note, we might start with the showing. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism.
So that's one part of the Silent Spring story. But the Silent Spring story, with that very, very strong resonance here to Michigan and MSU. And in recognizing the significance of the impacts of the book Silent Spring and the fact that it had this wonderful, wonderful local resonance, the museum decided some years ago to recognize the 50th anniversary by developing an exhibit. And we've called the exhibit Echoes of Silent Spring, 50 Years of Environmental Awareness. And I'm just going to give a short PowerPoint which kind of sets what you've just seen within the bigger story of Silent Spring. And I would also just mention that as part of our exhibit, and what the Knight Centre didn't have when they made that, was a short 16mm film footage taken in the early 1960s by a colleague of George Wallace called Alfred Edder. We got that footage amongst some other archival materials, wonderful archival materials, and I'll mention them in just a moment. And we're showing that in our exhibit now. Well, about 8 minutes of the 10 minutes of the short footage. And it actually shows a lot of the impacts of the birds on campus. It shows robins and many other birds affected by, as they're called, tremors. Tremors always seem such a trivial term. This is convulsions. I mean, this is an animal that's thrashing itself to death. Tremors really doesn't do it justice. So it's very powerful footage. And as I say, it was taken contemporary with the studies of Wallace and his two students, John Maynard and Richard Bernard. If the Knight Centre had that footage, I spoke with Lou Doria as we were putting the exhibit together. I said, "Mate, have you seen this footage?" And he said, "No, he hadn't. He only wished they had had it available when they were actually making the documentary." But nonetheless, I think it's an excellent documentary, very powerful, and it gets a lot going within that 28 minutes. Now, there we go. Oops. Now, let's see if this is going to work for us. Just press it. I don't think it's on, is it? Do I have to do something to get it on first? There's always, yes, first turn on. There we go. There we go. So just right, that's got it. So Echoes of Silent Spring, 50 years of environmental awareness that we're running through for the rest of the year, based of course on and around the book Silent Spring. That's the original first edition publication on the left. Came out in September 1962, but had actually been serialized in the New Yorker earlier. Three editions of the New Yorker from beginning in June 16 included the full text of Silent Spring. So, in fact, the reaction to Silent Spring was happening even before the book was published in September 1962. Rachel Carson, of course. Rachel Carson, contrary to many suggestions levelled at her by her critics, was a highly trained scientist. She had her master's from Johns Hopkins, was certainly going to be studying towards a PhD, but had to leave her studies in order to support her family. She had to work, had to make the money. Not her nuclear family. Rachel Carson never married, never had children, but supported her mother and her sister and her sister's kids, and had a long relationship, especially with one of her nephews, throughout her life. She joined Fish and Wildlife, or what is now the Fish and Wildlife Service, mostly, in fact, in the writing and editing side, and in fact moved very high in their ranks because she was very capable at translating science into easily understood popular literature. And that was always her great skill. But any suggestion levelled at her that she didn't bring with her adequate scientific training is completely unjustified. She was a scientist as well as a writer. She produced three books on the ocean, Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and The Edge of the Sea, mostly through the 1950s. And these were very well received, well, especially from The Sea Around Us on. Under the Sea Wind was a bit of a sleeper until The Sea Around Us became a bestseller. The Edge of the Sea, another bestseller. And in fact, it allowed her to leave her work with Fish and Wildlife. And she could concentrate pretty well full time on writing. Later, in fact, posthumously, a book was published called The Sense of Wonder, which is actually based on some short writing she did. It's actually a delightful book if you can get a copy of that. And it's directed at children. It talks about her wandering through the woods and along the ocean that she loved with her nephew. And she certainly always retained that sense of wonder in nature. But with Silent Spring, her focus changed. Her earlier books on the ocean were certainly scientific, but they were, as is often called, very lyrical works, almost poetic in a way. Silent Spring was a much harder subject matter, and she'd started to become aware of the impacts of pesticides, or as she had seen them, for some time, and set herself the task of writing a book which would actually manifest and document those unintended impacts of pesticides. This was at a time when Rachel Carson was in deteriorating health. Rachel Carson died in 1964 of cancer, barely 18 months after Silent Spring was published. So a lot of her engagement with all the investigation, all the criticism, all of the responses she had to give was at a time of extreme ill health. And in fact, her editor for Silent Spring is documented as saying that he seriously doubted that she would ever finish the book. But she did. She did. The book, of course, is about all sorts of pesticides, not just DDT. But DDT was the pesticide of choice coming out of World War II. So DDT was being used, well, really everywhere. And we see some wonderful, wonderful advertisements like, the DDT is good for... I mean, it's just glorious stuff in the way in which it was being promoted, because the belief was it was a panacea. It was a miracle solution to the problems of all sorts of pests. It did, as the documentary explained, really achieve its prominence in World War II, where it was very effective against malarial mosquitoes and the lice which carried typhus from people to people. And because DDT doesn't have acute toxicity on mammals, was liberally sprayed on people, and people didn't keel over dead or show many effects at all. And in the time that it was being sprayed locally and elsewhere all over America, kids would run through the fumes in the streets. There are many people who remember it. Either when the planes went overhead or the big rotor miss sprayers, people would be coated in DDT. It is not acute toxic, it doesn't have acute toxicity for mammals. There's a lot of debate and contention about what its chronic toxicity, though, of course, which eventually led in part to its banning, as well as its effect on other animals, particularly fish and birds, which do in fact yield to the effects of DDT. I mean, you had these wonderful flit ads with Dr. Seuss-type cartoon characters. And as we've got in our exhibit, advertisements for wallpaper. You can't see it very well there, but that wallpaper is decorated with Disney characters. It's Mickey Mouse and Goofy and Donald Duck. And it's for kids' bedrooms. It's impregnated with DDT. So here's George Wallace, as you've just met him. The DDT wasn't just sprayed from planes, it was sprayed from planes, but it was also sprayed by these big roto mist sprayers which would drive around the campus and around the streets of Lansing. As you've heard, it was being widely used against mosquitoes, but once it started to be used against the Dutch, the elm bark beetles to control Dutch elm disease, it was used in even higher concentrations than it was against mosquitoes, and that's largely the reason why the acute effects became so evident once it started to be used against Dutch elm disease here on the campus in 1954. The robin, the state bird, much loved. So to lose robins was actually even perhaps more symbolic and evocative than any other bird that was part of the fauna. There's George Wallace with a selection of the birds that were collected by him and his students, and a number of the specimens. They are the museum specimens. We most certainly don't have all the ones which are up in that top photograph, but when you come and see our exhibit, you'll see a number of the actual specimens of robins which were collected by Wallace and his students. What we got with the archive, as well as that film footage, were 28 letters between George Wallace and Rachel Carson, which documented their correspondence over around 8 years. We have a number of those original letters in the display. And it shows a relationship that built a warm relationship, but a professional one over that time. Carson first approaching Wallace about his research, asking him to provide her with more information, him responding very quickly and very happily, feeding information about the research through to her. She, of course, was doing this with all sorts of other cases as well, not just this one. So a huge amount of research went into Silent Spring. But this is certainly one of the case studies that gets most prominent, certainly probably as many pages set to this as any other. And of course, it's the story which kind of gives rise to the name of the book, because Silent Spring was the spring which didn't have the song of birds, the song of robins. It continued right through, this correspondence continued right through into early 1964. And the last letter we have from Rachel Carson to George Wallace was about 6 weeks before she died. So it really became a long-term relationship. As far as we know, they never met. Now, with the release of the book, well, you heard about what happened on campus, but of course, writ large, the controversy just swept America, and not just within America, around the world. The criticisms leveled at Carson. If man were to follow the teachings of Miss Carson, you'll notice Miss Carson. There's lots and lots of reference to gender allusions, etc. Her lack of a doctorate, and so forth. We would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth. White Stevens just happened to work for one of the companies, of course. Thanks to an emotional alarmist book called Silent Spring, Americans mistakenly believe their world is being poisoned. Carson is a fanatic defender of the cult of the balance of nature. I mean, I love that one. I mean, the balance of nature is a cult. You know, it's 50 years ago. I mean, what's really telling here is how the change of attitudes has come in, you know, and how different we do tend to look at the world from what it was in those times. But balance of nature, then, the fact that we could be part of something, that nature was something we were part of, not that we were at war with, that was a cult. You know, that was just unacceptable. That was non-scientific. No matter how deceitful her prose, the influence of Silent Spring has been very great and contributes 30 years later to shape environmental propaganda and fundraising as well as US policy. That's 1992. Go online, folks. Google Rachel Carson or Silent Spring and you'll find the debate is still alive and kicking. It is not over. This is not history. This is still a contentious story. Now, on her side, of course, there were many. In fact, with time, there were more supporters. These are the words from the Presidential Medal of Freedom that she was awarded posthumously in 1980. Never silent herself in the face of destructive trends, Rachel Carson fed a spring of awareness across America and beyond. Concerned, eloquent, she created a tide of environmental consciousness that has not ebbed. From Al Gore, Silent Spring had a profound impact. Indeed, Rachel Carson was one of the reasons I became so conscious of the environment, so involved with environmental issues. E.O. Wilson is one of the great students of biodiversity, a great entomologist. Silent Spring delivered a galvanic shock to public consciousness and as a result infused environmental movement with new substance and meaning. It might be a little overstating it to say it was the start of the environmental movement, but it certainly transformed it and it certainly did galvanize it. And the last one I love, this is a little quote from George Wallace in his memoirs. Talk about understatement. My involvement with pesticides made me unpopular among some segments of the college community. If you read the book, he doesn't mention much about this time at all. Yeah, it's you kind of have to think he quite deliberately has excised a lot of that controversy out of his memoirs. You know, he talks about birds and birding and so on. He's got a couple of other references, but not a lot when you think of what he went through for those years. What we do in the exhibit is then take it further. We start to explore a number of the things that George Wallace and his students and Silent Spring touch upon, things which now we largely take for granted, but which were not known then. You heard about things like bioaccumulation and biomagnification, such as the figure on the left there, how concentrations can increase as you go up the food chain. That was not well appreciated at that time. So the causal mechanisms, as they said, were not very well known. We talk about things like persistence, like those graphs in the top showing how, yes, DDT levels in various tests decline, but they persist. We talk about the way in which pesticides in general can move into the atmosphere, can move into water, can stay in the soils. And we also talk about something which doesn't get mentioned in that documentary. There's no particular reason that it should. But even at this time, even when all of this was happening, there was growing evidence of the capacity for insects to develop resistance. And in fact, in the exhibit, we have a quote from 1952, 10 years before Silent Spring, from the Secretary of the Department of Agriculture, bemoaning the fact that DDT is now not having the effect it used to have on flies, mosquitoes, and a whole range of other pests. This is about 5 or 6 years after the war, and it's already starting to lose its impact, very conveniently being ignored. I say to people, and people are sometimes shocked, I say to people, Rachel Carson saved the pesticide industry. Because if pesticides had continued to be used the way they were back there, there wouldn't be any insects today that hadn't built up sufficient resistance against everything. It's only because we no longer use pesticides the way that they were being used in the 50s that we have managed to maintain the effect of pesticides on the things they're supposed to kill. We talk in the exhibit as well, not just about the birds of campus, we talk about the impact on fish. That's a really nasty story, killing birds, but that wasn't what really girded the loins of government against DDT. What really elicited response was when the fish in the lakes started to show high levels of DDT and other pesticides, because then the real risk was presented of the whole collapse, complete collapse of the commercial and recreational fisheries of Michigan and the Great Lakes. Then people started to get worried. Then they really started to panic. We talk about the raptors. Robins died, yes, through concentrating through their diet of earthworms. But typically birds right at the top of the food chains, food pyramids, are the ones which often show the worst effects. And bald eagles, peregrine falcons, brown pelicans, and a whole raft of other birds, which are at the top of the chain, really started to fall off in populations across the United States and elsewhere as DDT was being heavily used. And of course, we now appreciate that this was largely through the effects of DDT and its breakdown product DDE in thinning the eggshells of the birds. It interferes with calcium deposition, so the birds would sit on the eggs and they would break their own eggs. And it looked for a while as if the bald eagle might become extinct within contiguous mainland United States. With the banning of DDT in 1972, its numbers and peregrines and a whole raft of other birds have come back enormously. There are those who dispute, though, that DDT is the cause, and that's also a hot topic today. Check that. You'll find that's not accepted entirely even today. We talk a little about the use of pesticides in other environments, the bottom photograph in Vietnam. Not DDT there, but something, in fact, much, much worse than DDT. In the spraying of the rainbow pesticides, Agent Orange was the most widely used, of course, and it's a mix of a number of pesticides, 24D, 245T, and dioxin, which has been called the most deadly chemical ever developed by man. And the effects of that were and are widespread and awful, absolutely awful. And so we actually frame that in the context of pesticides being used as almost an agent of war. We talk about biological control. Rachel Carson advocated for this instead of pesticides, but biological control is risky as well. You put the wrong biological agents in, you can have a pest that's worse, far worse, than in fact the pest you were trying to control. So the same message applies. You still have to have caution. You cannot have a flagrant and profligate application of any kind of technologies. You must be very cautious. You must understand what you're doing. Following, of course, the contention substantially. Rachel Carson was vindicated by the scientific investigations of her. She now appears on stamps. Protected areas are named after her. She was given the Medal of Freedom. The Environmental Protection Agency was established in 1970. It's called the extended, often called the extended shadow of Silent Spring. Love it or hate it, it did at least concentrate monitoring and legislative control in an agency which was incorporating environmental concerns rather than just agricultural concerns. So pesticides were set within their overall impacts on the environment. And the movement to ban DDT and other pesticides came in. DDT was eventually banned in the United States in 1972. It was actually essentially banned in Michigan earlier. Michigan picked up on it. For all the controversy that happened at, around George Wallace, MSU recognized and changed practices pretty quickly. 1970, as you heard, the Pesticide Research Center was established with Gordon Geyer as its first director. In 1969, MSU ceased to recommend DDT for use, 1969. By the end of 1969, Michigan had banned it. And it took until 1972 before the United States in total effectively banned it. So MSU and Michigan were on the leading edge after all of that controversy that was happening earlier. Now, that's the Pesticide Research Center as it was around 1970, top left. Now, in fact, Dutch elm disease is treated, as you see in that photo on the top right. Fungicide is injected into the elms directly. You don't spray it with a broad-based pesticide, an insecticide. You actually target the fungicide. It's labor-intensive. It's expensive. It has to be done every second year. But it's the reason why MSU today is one of the best places to find still American elms. And you can still find around 700 elms on campus. There used to be over 5,000. But in a lot of other places, the elms are effectively gone. You'll see in the top right, that's in fact, you heard on the documentary, that's in fact the award that was made to George Wallace, signed by Gordon Geyer, an honorary doctorate recognizing his contributions. And today we have the Wallace Endowed Scholarship for Ornithology, the young girl in the bottom left corner, whose name is Rachel. I can't remember her last name. Do you remember? Eaton. Rachel. Rachel Eaton. Very appropriate. And MSU also has a Rachel Carson Chair in Sustainability these days. So they're the chap on the bottom right. And so their names live on at MSU. In the exhibit, we talk about modern impacts, the way in which pesticides are used today, like nematode pesticides injected into the soil. We touch on things like genetically modified organisms, that top right-hand graph, where you look at the soybeans and the cotton and the corn in the United States today, and how two major approaches are to develop herbicide-tolerant crops, whereby you can then apply much, much more pesticide to the crops because they're resistant while the weeds aren't. And the other is you insert genes into the crops, particularly a gene from Bacillus thuringiensis, BT crops. And by putting that gene into the genome of the crop, that plant has a built-in pesticide. So insects eat it and they die. Most of the corn, most of the soybeans, most of the cotton in the United States are genetically modified, and they have these. So that's a direct relationship to pesticide use, but now it's actually in the crops. We talk a little about organic farming and how that's kind of a backlash against it. This is now people talking. People don't, you know, speaking with their pockets and their wallets. They don't want crops which have got pesticides on them or have had artificial fertilizers used, and certainly not genetically modified, although there's a lot of dispute as to whether those crops are better for you or not. And we talk about, in the bottom there, bottom right, integrated pest management, which is actually what Rachel Carson always said. There are people who say Rachel Carson wanted pesticides banned. She never said that. There's not one word in her book which ever says that. She never advocated for the banning of DDT. What she said was, let's be careful. These are potentially dangerous chemicals. Let's just be wary in how we use them. Let's not just throw them around. That's what integrated pest management is about, and that's what all good agriculture advisors today, this college and every other one. There's a place for chemicals, but one sliver of the pie. And what you try to do is do the other things well, so you don't have to use the chemicals very much. Not only does that mean you're not using these toxins, you're saving money. So that, she never used the word integrated pest management, the term, but that's actually what she was advocating, and that's modern agricultural practice. Back then, protective clothing was what you see with the guys up on the top left corner. Three of them have got hats. That's about the extent of it. You know, that was about all you'd see. These days, you know, we know a little bit more. You're going to be applying pesticides in a, you know, large-scale application. You tend to wear breathing apparatus and suits and things like that. We've learnt that. And another neat element, and I referred to it a little, not a lot, was that a lot of Rachel Carson's critics did home in on her gender and the suggestions that a mere woman should not be engaging her mind with what is really men's business, you know, science, tough stuff like that. And when she was, in fact, with Fish and Wildlife, there weren't that many women scientists. That's the truth. She was certainly an exception. Now, in the College of Natural Science on campus, 52% of the students are women. And we profile just a number. We do about six of the women on campus who are members of the Graduate Women in Science group. And it's nice to see just what they are now doing and the sort of research. And we remind people how far we've come in 50 years, perhaps not right through the glass ceiling, but women are very active as practicing scientists and respected in that capacity. But the debate over DDT lives on. We talk about the debate today about malaria. There are those who call Rachel Carson a mass murderer. You'll find that reference to her quite frequently. Because it's suggested she said DDT should be banned. DDT kills mosquitoes which carry malaria, and thus everyone who's caught malaria is basically died because Rachel Carson made it. So, you know, it is a nonsense, but it's an attitude which is promulgated. As I said a little earlier, if pesticides had been used, continued to be used the way they were being used in the 50s, there'd be nothing that would kill malarial mosquitoes now. Absolutely nothing. It's because practices change that anything does in fact kill them. But there is probably a fair argument and a debate and dialogue happening now about whether or not there is a place for DDT to be applied inside houses in developing countries as a mosquito repellent and mosquito killer. And there are respected scientists and medicos who are advocating that position. We don't take a position either side of that. What we do draw people's attention to the fact that this debate is still happening. Very quickly to finish up, why have we told this story? We think it's a good one. It's global significance and impacts. It's a book that changed the world, but it's got this local relevance with the parallel story here that you've just seen through the documentary. Demonstrates the evolution of society and of the university. There are natural links with current and topical research and issues. The story is still a very hot story. And we don't even touch upon another wonderful parallel discussion and debate about climate change and just how that is being explored today. But the museum has collections as well that support the story. We have the robins, we have the archives. So it's history, science, and contemporary issues. So it's got everything going for it. So we've set up the exhibit. We've got modular exhibits at several sites around campus which profile research happening here at MSU related to the story. We have a campus walking trail. We have some maps there if you haven't got one already. You can do it with the map, the printed map, or you can do it with your mobile phone. Just download the GPS app and it'll walk you around the campus to about 12 sites which relate to the story. And we have the online exhibit, etc. We've got talks and things, and we've got things like this happening which are all nice expansions to it. There's our exhibit. If you haven't come by, please do. There's the walking trail. It's still, weather's still okay, folks. You've still got, I reckon, about another month to 6 weeks that you can enjoy this. So get out there. And it's a great story. And Pam, why don't you relate a couple of associated things which you've been involved in.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to talk about one small aspect of this story, and this is a sort of a spin-off of the main exhibit, something that we're calling the cold case, and I'll explain why. So much of what I have is kind of a repeat of what you've already heard, but I'll just skim over some of that. Anyway, so just before Silent Spring was published, Dr. Wallace became embroiled in this big problem. It was an unexpected involvement in his case. He had no idea this was going to happen, but he actually had a student, just coincidentally, had a student studying robins before the DDT spraying started, and the student found very high reproductive success and large numbers of robins on campus, which was the way it had always been. We never thought that anything would happen to our robins. Nobody thought that. So it was just by chance that John Maynor happened to be studying robins. And the next year, spraying started. Robins were being found dead and dying with tremors all over campus and elsewhere. And this is just a few of the robins that were found. Now, they weren't all found in one day by any means. They were found over periods of weeks every spring, basically. And these had been then tagged and put in the freezer. And then their tissues were sampled, et cetera. And it wasn't just robins. It was many other species of birds. But robins were the big losers in this. And even if they didn't die, they would not be able to breed. They would start to breed, and it wouldn't work out. And that was despite the fact that in 1954, they had been doing really, really well, as they normally do. And it was also surprising that more robins were found dead than were known to be breeding on campus. So the campus was serving as a sink, basically, for robin populations. Robins would come in happily, they'd die, and then new robins would come in to fill the void, and then they'd die too. So it was pretty bad. And it was never a case that robins were going to go extinct totally in the wild, because we're talking about a small area. But with this scene being repeated over and over again across the country, you can see the problem. Well, Wallace and his students suspected DDT. I mean, it was a natural assumption to make. There's a lot of DDT spraying happening, and robins are dying. But as we've seen, it wasn't clear what was happening at first. But they started doing the tests. They started testing the brain and fat and other tissue samples and finding very high levels of DDT. Well, now that doesn't tell you that it's DDT that's killing the robins. That tells you there's DDT in the birds, but it's a pretty good clue. And then they started doing experiments. And these may sound a little grisly, but this was a big deal. This was an important thing. And they used house sparrows, which are considered a vermin species anyway, an invasive species, and fed them DDT, and quite quickly they died with tremors, exactly the same kind of tremors that robins were showing. And they also did some experiments with robins in captivity and found the same thing. And then they had a couple of kestrels, these beautiful little falcons, and fed the kestrels, the house sparrows that had died from DDT poisoning. Within like 4 days, the kestrels were dead. And they didn't even eat that much of the sparrow, so it was a tiny amount of DDT that killed these kestrels. So most people rather quickly became convinced, based on these data and other data that other people around the country had been doing, that DDT had this effect on robins. And here's a different study done around the same time in New Hampshire that showed that of birds that were control birds from unsprayed areas, DDT levels in the brain were quite low. Birds on the bottom column that were found dying of tremors had very, very high levels of DDT in the brain. And the middle column is birds that were found dead of unknown causes. So you can see the tremendous range. This shouldn't say average, because it's a group that's, this is not an average, obviously, but anyway, you can see the tremendous range between birds that were found dead for some unknown reason, and some of them must not have been poisoned by DDT, while others almost certainly were. Well, as we've seen, Rachel Carson learned from Wallace's early publications on the subject about his investigations into DDT and wrote him. And we have those letters. That was just quite a coincidence, because the curators at the museum were called up some years after his death, called up by his family to go and get his books and whatever we wanted to save from his library, and we went up there to his house and got the books, and there was a huge amount of correspondence, and we didn't have time to go over it, read through it or anything, but we just thought, well, you know, there might be something in here relating to Silent Spring Robins. So we gathered up the correspondence, and lo and behold, these letters turn up, and the film. Anyway, original letters from Rachel Carson. So what do you know? Anyway, so they had this extensive correspondence, and that ended up with the Robins, of course, being a prominent case study that's referred to again and again in Silent Spring. Well, as we've seen, some people don't want to believe it, and they may have their reasons, but for example, the website The Lies of Rachel Carson says that Wallace theorized that the Robins were killed by DDT. Doesn't mention that he actually tested them and found a lot of DDT in the brain. And it does mention, however, that Wallace didn't take account for the fact that mercury was being used as well as a fungicide on campus. And it mentions in that website that that birds poisoned by mercury show similar symptoms. Well, perhaps, but that doesn't mean it's mercury. Anyway, so we happen to have, as Gary has said, some of the Robins. Unfortunately, not very many of them. It would be great if we had all of them, but several of the Robins and two of the feeding experiment kestrels in the MSU Museum collection. And Gary Morgan, suggested some time ago that we should do an analysis of this. We should retest for DDT. And we brought in Dr. Andreas Lehner and Dr. George Buchheim from the College of Vet Med, from the Diagnostic Center for Populations and Animal Health, who agreed to analyze the samples. Well, this is just a list of the birds sampled, and it's a really small number, but that's what we have. So this is all we can sample. There's one more robin that we could have sampled. So what we had was two individuals that we know died of tremors, and for each species, and one that was meant to be a control. As we'll see, control didn't work out quite as we had expected. But the sampling procedure was one that is not typical, because it's now becoming common for scientists to do destructive sampling, taking a small piece of the bottom of the foot pad of a bird specimen, or some of the skin of the belly, and using that for DNA studies, et cetera. But we wanted to try to do this non-destructively, and it worked out much better than I ever imagined, because all I had to do was to humidify the specimens in a humid chamber, and then I could open up the belly incision, because specimens are basically the skin with the feathers on it surrounding a cotton body, and there's a few like wing and leg bones, but that's all that's left. And anyway, so I could open up the incision, and there was the cotton, and my thought was that we would remove some of the cotton and be able to find residues from the fat that's on the skin, and or maybe some brain tissue or something, and test that. It turned out that there was a significant amount of dermal muscle on the inside of the skin that I could remove without damaging the skin at all. And so I did that for each of the specimens, sewed them up, and you can't tell that anything was done. So also a tiny number of little feathers fell out when I was doing that. So we saved those, and those got tested. In fact, you can test feathers for mercury. The mercury doesn't go anywhere, so it's easily tested. And this is what was found by Dr. Lehner and Buchheim. Very, very little mercury. So birds like bald eagles and herring gulls can have extremely high levels of mercury in their feathers because they biomagnify it. These birds had very low to medium low levels, and so we have no evidence that mercury was the culprit. And this is what's called a fingerprint analysis using mass spectrometry. And so this is a library basically spectrum for DDE, the breakdown, one of the breakdown products of DDT. And you can see this robin, 8397, one of our specimens, shows very clearly that that's DDE. And here's the range of concentrations. And like I said, we weren't expecting this. We were expecting that these are our two birds that were dying of tremors, the two robins that were dying of tremors, and these are the two kestrels that had that were poisoned by DDT. So this is not what we were expecting. And what we would need is a much larger sample to probably get better results. But what we found was that this bird that was collected as a control at Rose Lake, which was not sprayed, had very high levels of DDT. So this is actually not too surprising because birds can fly. And it's also not surprising because birds that are healthy can actually survive with high levels of DDT. For some time. It's only when they start to undergo some kind of stress and then they start to use up their fat, which has the DDT in it, that then suddenly the DDT kicks in and you get the effects. And then basically they tremor, and because when they're tremoring, they can't do anything. They can't do their normal activities. They can't feed, and then they just die. It basically becomes a loop. They can't feed, so then they start using more fat, and then they starve to death. Anyway, so not what we were expecting, but the low levels of DDT in the kestrels is also not surprising because it has been shown elsewhere that kestrels have a very low level of tolerance to DDT. There have been plenty of experiments showing that. They are a model species for DDT studies in raptors. So raptors have very low tolerance for DDT. Conclusions, wasn't mercury. We can't say it was DDT, but we can say, certainly seems likely, and there's plenty of DDT present 50 years later at high levels. And it's not the pattern that we expected exactly because our control, Wallace's control robin, had plenty of DDT. And I want to make the point that if we hadn't had these museum specimens, we wouldn't have been able to do this. This is just one further example of the importance of museum specimens. And I want to end on a positive note, which is that I saw so many robins on campus this spring. They were everywhere. And that we hope that will continue. So thank you.
Well, thanks, folks.